Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, D.C. Malawian authorities dropped charges against former President Bakili Mulusi. We'll have his reaction.
The Director General of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, Lucas Kondowe, who headed the Anti-Corruption Bureau, actually said that he didn't say anything wrong.
A cross-section of Zambians say verbal attacks against two clergymen must stop.
Democracy is not a spectator sport. And one form of participation is actually freedom of expression, where people express their opinions on a number of things.
And Sierra Leone's main opposition All People's Congress, or APC, calls on the police chief to investigate violence against its supporters. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Bakili Mulusi says he feels vindicated after the Director of Public Prosecutions dropped all charges against him. Reacting to the decision, the former president maintains that the charges were politically motivated. Mulusi and his former personal secretary were charged with abusing $1.7 million of public funds. He sharply denies the charge. Critics say the charges against the former president, who served two full-year terms in office, should not have been dropped. They argue that the fight against corruption could be affected due to the decision. For more reaction to the situation, I reach former Malawian President Bakili Mulusi.
Well, you see, all along I knew that this matter will one day be withdrawn, because the Director General of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, Lucas Kondowe, who headed the Anti-Corruption Bureau, actually said that he didn't say anything wrong what I did. And the second person who also became the Director General, Mr. Matemba, said the same thing. So what has happened is what actually should happen, because this was politically motivated, something which was orchestrated by late Bingwa Mutharika, may his soul rest in peace. There was nothing wrong I did.
Do you feel vindicated?
I do feel very vindicated, because this is what I have been telling the people of Malawi and the international community all along, to say the so-called corruption, the money which came into my account, all the money was personally given to me as Bakili Mulusi, and it's not to government. You know, anything to do with the government, it goes to account number one of the Reserve Bank. So this is what we have been telling all along, but people could not believe it. But now they have looked at it and they have discovered that there is no issue at all. There was no criminal activity which actually was done. That's why the court said no, we should not continue.
Some of your critics have always maintained that the monies that were given to you supposedly personally wouldn't have been given to you were you not to be president of Malawi. You were given that money as a result of the office that you occupy. Then it's for the people of Malawi and not necessarily for you. And that is why they think that the corruption charges should not have been dropped against you. How do you respond to that?
No. They are wrong. You know, I was head of a political party since the 1990s. And I run a political party. And this was given to me to run the party. We bought vehicles, we bought materials for the party. It was not really meant for me personally, you know, from my family. It was meant for the party. So it's the party which was given the money for, nothing to do with government.
Well, Mr. President, what do you say to those who are saying that it was because of your cordial relationship with current President Dr. Lazarus Chakwera that these charges were dropped? And secondly, they said you used delay tactics, including, you know, using your treatment for spinal problems to delay it until somebody favorable or nice to you came to office to drop the charges against you.
No, it's not. What actually, the person who was dropped is not the president, is the director of public prosecution, who is the independent, body, and that's the person who is a lawyer, and he looked at it, nothing to do with the President Chakwera at all, and nothing to do with the relationship between me and President Chakwera.
With these charges being dropped, Mr. President, does that mean that it will not be brought up in the future?
Well, if anyone would like to look it again, if they want to do, but they will find nothing. Because, like I have told you, the director of SPB, two directors who looked at this case, even the person who investigated that time told the court that I had known money which actually was given to me, personally, to not have affected the arrest in some 15 years ago. So if anyone wants to take it again, the matter, they'll find the same answer.
So, Mr. President, what is your message to the people of Malawi regarding the dropping of charges against you vis-a-vis the fight against financial malfeasance or corruption or wrongdoing in Malawi?
The organization which is called the SCB, Anti-Corruption Bureau in Malawi, it was when I was in office, that actually established that office, because it's part of a democratic institutions to support democracy in the country. And, the fight must continue. It is important. Government money cannot be taken and be used for personal use. And those that are found, definitely they must be arrested. That's my view.
Bakili Muluzi is a former Malawian president. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Africa, the main opposition Democratic Alliance is calling for the resignation or firing of Minister of Police Bheki Cele. The party accuses him of failing to curb what it says are the crimes across the country, which they say are spiraling out of control. This after the latest police report on crime shows that almost three people are killed every hour. It also says there was a 3.4% increase in murders from last year. But dismissing the demand for his resignation, Cele said the overall picture was improving. For analysis on the latest crime data and the demand for the resignation of the Minister of Police, I reached human rights activist Mary Dehas.
Okay, look, the crime statistics that were just released are not that different from the previous quarter. Crime has been abnormally high for a country that's not at war. We have serious crime problems, violent crime. And look, the minister is part of the problem. The minister is definitely part of the problem. The man is, he basically is a lawn to himself. He runs the police operation, which is unconstitutional. We have a national commissioner for that. He's got a history. He even said he was a warlord in the 90s. Nobody understands why the president keeps him. He's got criminal charges against him for fraud, which haven't been prosecuted. The man is untouchable.
So, Mary, you think the removal of the police minister by President Cyril Ramaphosa
could be a step in trying to resolve some of these concerns about the spiraling of crime in South Africa?
It's the first step. It's the first step. I must tell you that about 3 or 4 years ago, you will remember probably because it was international, the people killed at Marikana.
Right.
All those people killed at Marikana several years back, the mining in the Northwest.
I remember,
where
yes.
They were gunned down, and there was a commission of inquiry. Coming out of that, there was a report on reforming the police. That report was handed to the minister 4 years ago, and it says it tells the steps that have to be taken. You start with the appointment of a policing board, because at the moment it's everybody's friends, relatives, lovers that get appointed into the police. It's a nepotistic network. There's a lot of good police, and they suffer because if they speak out against corruption, they'll be dismissed illegally. It's dreadful, this, what the situation with the police. Now, there's a policy document about training police, appointing police. It's been sitting in the minister's drawer for 4 years. We need to start with that policy. That means you have to get rid of the minister. You have to get the board appointed. The other problem we have is that there's no oversight of the police, because we have an oversight body that our constitutional court said 6 years ago had to be given independence from the Ministry of Police. Parliament hasn't passed the legislation, so the minister appoints the head of the oversight body that is actually supposedly oversight of the police that he controls. He's acting completely illegally, and nobody touches him. It's dreadful.
Presenting the report, the police minister is saying that there seemed to be an improvement apart from rape, where there was a 20% rise. But he says there is an improvement from last year's report. What is your take on that?
You can't extrapolate from one report 1 year to the other. If you want to say there's an up or down spiral in crime, you've got to take at least half a dozen years. I've forgotten the exact number, but statistically, it's meaningless to say, well, it's higher the 3 months. The last 3 months is higher than this year. You've got to look at things over a longer period of time. And for a long period of time, our crime rate has been abnormally high, talking violent crime and even gender-based violence, the rape of children. I mean, it is appalling. And it goes back to the fact that we don't have proper crime intelligence, that the police are basically there because they most of them have got where they are during the Zuma period. And the people that were close to Zuma, that's how they got politically integrated, appointed as police. And we've got a lot of good police. I spent my life working for good police who try to do their jobs, risk their lives, never get promoted, all because the people in management in the police, provincially and nationally, are only there because the government through clearly wants them. I mean, it's crazy. It's one big nepotistic network. How can you bring crime down if you haven't got police who do their jobs?
Mary De Haas is a human rights activist. She spoke with me from the South African capital, Pretoria. A cross-section of Zambians is expressing concern over what they see are verbal attacks by a leading member of the governing United Party for National Development, or UPND, targeting some Catholic priests. This after Anthony Salangeta, a priest at the Lusaka Chawama Catholic Parish, criticized the government. He urged President Hakainde Hichilema to talk about bread and butter issues instead of using graphs to explain the performance of the economy. His comments were backed by Archbishop Alick Banda. But the Secretary General of the UPND, Batuke Nmenda, accused the two priests of using the pulpit to attack the government and the president. He accused them of being sympathizers of the main opposition party and should be considered as opponents of the government.
Meanwhile, in an about-face, the national spokesperson of the UPND, Cornelius Mwitua, says the party plans to arrange a meeting with the church to resolve the ongoing spat. For analysis and reaction, I reach Dr. Alex Ngoma. He is a retired professor of political science at the University of Zambia.
I think it's important to put on record to begin with that wherever democracy has been implemented as a political system, there has to be political participation, because democracy is not a spectator sport. And one form of participation is actually freedom of expression, where people express their opinions on a number of things. What actually started this whole debate you hear about in Zambia is that a priest merely said that the president must not use graphs to explain what's going on in the country, because it's not everyone that has got the capacity to understand the graphs. And I think that the priest was actually very, very correct. You know, people who understand graphs in this country are those that have gone as far as college and university. And it's not everyone that has gone that far in education.
But do you think the response from the UPND Secretary General was appropriate? Because some people have said that it was unwarranted, it was uncalled for.
The response from the Secretary General of the UPND was very, very unnecessary, very unwarranted, in the sense that it actually demonstrates that the UPND and its leadership are actually very, very allergic to criticism. They want to be praised only. If you say anything negative, you instantly become an enemy. Look, the very same priests that they are criticizing today were a darling of theirs when the UPND was in opposition, because the priests have actually been very consistent. Where things are not going on as expected, they will comment and criticize and suggest the way forward. Where things are being done well, they will actually applaud the doers. So this is what used to happen when the UPND was in opposition. The UPND was very happy with that. But now that the UPND is in government and the very same clergy is actually passing comments on the things that are not being right, the UPND cannot tolerate that. It is very, very unfortunate.
Some UPND supporters that I have spoken with are of the view that these priests appear to be against the UPND New Dawn government, as it is called, and that they are against President Hichilema and create criticism when there's not, just to make him unpopular ahead of the next general election. Your take on that?
I think that such sentiments from the UPND sympathizers are very much misplaced. The clergy in this country actually is known to be a voice of reason. It speaks for the voiceless in this country. When the UPND was in opposition, it used to enjoy such comments. But now that it is in government, it detests them. That is very, very strange. So no, the clergy is not the campaigning anyone. The clergy is simply putting the story as it is. When you go around the country, what the priests are saying is exactly what the people around the country are saying.
Well, Dr. Ngoma, some people are expressing concern from the UPND that it appears that these priests' comments appear to be tinged with tribalistic sentiment and are towing a political line, and they are backing the former ruling party, the Patriotic Front Party, using their pulpits.
No, that I think is completely wrong. It's completely false. False in the sense that, like I've been saying right from the very beginning, the clergy in Zambia has always been consistent, and it hasn't shifted from its consistency. Where things are not going on well, the clergy has always spoken against those things without due regard to who is in government. It's actually the issue, not the governors. And that is the way, the correct way to do it. I think everybody else appears to be politicking, but I think that the clergy is spot on. Spot on in the sense that the clergy does not, in fact, actually criticize. It gives counsel to those in public office and advises that people should listen to the suffering masses of the country. So there's no tribal inclination involved. There's no tribal tone involved. nothing like that at all.
Alex Ngoma is a retired professor of political science at the University of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka.
Would you like to be famous? Calling us on WhatsApp may gain you fame if we play your message on the radio. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. Here's that number again. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Legislative elections of Guinea-Bissau are scheduled to begin on June 4. VOA Portuguese service Alvaro Andrade is in the country's capital, Bissau, and spoke to some residents who share their hopes and expectations for the upcoming elections and has the story.
After 3 years of political instability, around 900,000 voters are expected to head to the polls in Guinea-Bissau, with hopes of finding a better path forward for the country. In the streets of the capital, Bissau, voters voiced high hopes as well as anxiety due to post-election violence in years past. Voting will start on Sunday, June 4th, with a field of candidates that includes 20 parties and two coalitions. More than 150 international observers have already arrived to witness voters go to the ballot box. Serifu Jamanka, a college student, says his country needs change to develop and have some political stability.
People, first of all, must think and reflect, not vote the same way, because we need change. How many years is going to be suspended? Till now, we are in the same boat. We must change. And I think it's good.
Another voter, Equitania Celestino Jumam, a university professor, says she is betting on election results to bring change because, she says, people vote along ethnic and religious lines.
Here in Guinea-Bissau, how people vote, they don't vote for the programs of the deputy because the deputies, they don't offer the programs, yes. People vote because of this person belongs to my ethnic group or he belongs to, we are in the same religion.
Jumem says it's important for citizens educate themselves about who they are voting for and how they will address their concerns.
We need people, the politics that are going to show us, their programs, the deputy that are come to us and talk to us. People should know their representative before voting in them. They should know them well.
Former Mozambican President Joaquim Chissano, who heads the African Union Observer Mission, is confident of a peaceful process, but recalls that in the past, conflicts have arisen after elections.
Everything happened after the elections. The country needs to move forward.
On June 4th, people will choose the new parliament and government. From Bissau to VOA, Álvaro Lugero Andrade.
In Sierra Leone, the main opposition All People's Congress, or APC, is calling on the Inspector General of Police to launch an investigation into violence against its supporters in some parts of the country. Attorney Lansana Dumbuya, General Secretary of the APC, says its members are being attacked in the strongholds of the governing Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP. He accused some police officers of being afraid to arrest the perpetrators, an accusation the police sharply deny. His concerns come after presidential candidates of the major political parties signed a peace pledge recently, a move observers say that signals their supporters not to engage in politically related violence in the run-up to the elections. Sierra Leoneans go to the polls on June 24 to choose a new president, legislators, mayors, and local representatives. Atenza Dumbuya tells me that his party is also calling on the international community to pressure the police and the authorities to help stop violence targeting supporters of the APC.
We've been attacked, our members, executives, and aspirants for mayoral, for the local council elections. Also for the members of parliament who are contesting for us, they have been attacked even our ordinary members who are mobilizing, who are jubilating, who are, you know, trying to campaign for us in the southeast, are being attacked in Pujaun, Moyamba, bombed, Kailaun, and some parts of Kenema, and also were being attacked at Palabar some few days ago, and even in Freetown, in some instances in Freetown, we've been attacked. And these attacks are not only done by the SLPP operatives. They are also, in some places, they're done in collaboration with the Sierra Leone police force.
Mr. Dumboya, is the APC calling on the government to rein in some of these so-called thugs who have been attacking your members?
They are thugs of the government, the SLPP that is in power. It is the SLPP thugs who are attacking our people, and they will use the T-shirt of the president, you know, the president's T-shirt. They will always wear the president's T-shirt, the face will be there, and they will attack. Recently, about 2 days ago, they went into our party office in Pujaun. They went there, walked majestically into the compound, and they tore the banner of our presidential candidate, aspirant, Dr. Samuel Kamara.
Some supporters of the SLPP are suggesting that anybody at all can wear the T-shirt of the ruling party and create chaos. Any thief or anybody trying to cause instability or create tension can wear a T-shirt of one party or another to create mischief and to make one party or the other unpopular. How sure are you that you have evidence that these people are members of the SLPP, and have you reported it to the area police, and what have they done about it?
The analogy you're saying there, Peter, may be true in some other cases, but for this one, who will do it? Who will do it? It has to be the SLPP people themselves. There is nowhere where somebody will wear SLPP T-shirt in Pujaun to go and pretend as if he is SLPP when he's not SLPP and attack the APC people. That is really, really, really far-fetched, to be honest with you.
I understand you. My question too now is, have you approached the SLPP party itself to address this concern that its members in their stronghold are attacking your members when you are campaigning?
I have called the Inspector General of Police, and we've issued out a press release, press statement, which we know they have, and it's a press release where it is public. If at all, let us say for once, if at all, and we have mentioned, we have indicated there clearly that these are SLPP operatives, and we have not done only one press release, we have done press releases, numbers of them, and we have named the SLPP there as people who are attacking us. They've not for once debunked that. They've not for once dissociated themselves from that. At least they should have done that, if at all they do not condone it, or they are not involved. If they are not involved, then they are condoning it, because they've not dissociated themselves from that to say, we are not concerned, we do not know what happened there, they are not our members. But these are really, let me say this to you, Peter, why, again, your analogy, your reasoning cannot hold in that regard, or the people who are giving you that analogy, it cannot hold. In some of these instances, our supporters have been able to arrest some of them. They've gone to the police, and the police have been able to identify them. But the thing is when our supporters arrested these people and will take them to the police, our supporters, who are the complainant there, would be the ones who would be detained at the police, and those people would be released. If it was an impostor, if it was somebody who was pretending I'm an impostor, I mean, they would have investigated him. In fact, they would have nailed him, make sure that they charged him to court.
Attorney Lansana Dumbuya is the General Secretary for the Sierra Leone Main Opposition All People's Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Nigeria, the Center for Social Justice, or CSJ, is expressing concern about the decision of the new government to remove fuel subsidies without consulting stakeholders. The CSJ contends that the removal of subsidies with no clear plan to cushion the effect will increase the financial burden of the average Nigerian. It is also calling on the government to transparently detail how the funds saved from the removal of the fuel subsidy will be used to benefit Nigerians. Eze Onyekpere is the lead director of the Center for Social Justice. He tells me that his organization is not against the move, but he adds that the lack of consultation could be a dangerous signal of authoritarian tendencies.
The Center for Social Justice has been a strong advocate for the removal of subsidy on PMS, specifically for the reasons that it's no longer sustainable. Fiscally sustainable, we are using over 94% of our national income, all the money we make in Nigeria, to service debt. So even the fuel subsidy is funded from borrowed money. And secondly, it was a conduit for corruption. So we are in support of its removal. But we have a challenge with the process and the strategy. First is that there should have been an engagement and consultation between the federal government and stakeholders, for instance, in organized labor and the private sector and every other stakeholder, for there to be an agreement and a consensus on some form of palliative measures, okay, for the poorest of the poor, maybe in transportation and in food. And of course, to have an agreement, because the reform package should be a composite one.
Eze, you also questioned the willingness of the political class to make corresponding sacrifices. But do you think this is feasible?
Yes.
Because a lot of civil society groups like yours have said so, and they appear not to be moving an inch.
We are saying that the political class should cut down on whatever they take from government, whatever they earn. There is even a recommendation to increase what they take home. So, and these are the issues why there's always resistance each time to fuel subsidy, because some people are going to suffer more, while others will simply not even cut down a little. But I believe if there's a substantial push from civil society, from the media, from organized labor, the political class will have no option but to sit down and think through what they're doing, because we are also going to borrow money to be paying them. If you are spending 94% of your return revenue in debt service, the money you use for salary is borrowed, capital expenditure is borrowed, fuel subsidy is borrowed. So virtually every other thing is borrowed, except servicing debt. So that's why I'm saying there should be a composite discussion. Fuel subsidy has to go, cost of governance has to be reduced. Where are those frivolous expenditures? Where are those issues around corruption? We take a decision on them all at once and then move forward.
So why do you think what you describe as the arbitrary nature of the decision to remove the subsidy is a dangerous signal of potential dictatorship? Because some Nigerians are saying this is what has been happening all along.
That's not the best practice. Assuming without conceding that some people have been arbitrary in the past, should we, in a new period of renewing our hope, encourage arbitrariness? Okay, look at even what happened a couple of days ago. The National Assembly sat on a Saturday and Sunday and amended Section 38 of the CBN Act, thereby increasing advances government could take from the CBN from 5% to 15%. And the 5% it was before was what led Nigeria to incur 23 trillion naira in terms of advances from CBN. And we don't know how to pay that. We had to securitize it over a long period of time, 20, 30 years, to pay back. And instead of holding firm on that rule, we are now giving the federal government more leeway from 5 to 15. To take more money from the CBN, and we are complaining that we want to reduce inflation. That literally means that the FGN can now print money not backed by value. And we are complaining about inflation and other things. So a lot is wrong. We shouldn't encourage arbitrariness on whatever ground.
So what do you think is the best way forward to as it were, cushion the effect of this, what your organization described as an arbitrary removal of the subsidy that has created somewhat of a shortage. And people are saying the oil marketers are taking advantage of the situation.
I think the government should appoint more officials that can engage stakeholders and tell them, well, we're sorry we've done this without consulting you, but it's not too late. What can we do to cushion the effect? And then, of course, suggestions will come from different stakeholders, and some of these governance reform issues will also be put on the table. Nigerians are ready to make sacrifices for their tomorrow, but they want to see their leaders champion these sacrifices. If the sacrifice is for everybody, it will be easier to tolerate. But when you get the impression that the guy who is asking you to make sacrifices simply overbloat it with the public, what comes from the public till, which ideally he should not have access to, it's going to be extremely difficult for people to take. So engagement, consultation, palliatives, and the way forward, because like I said, reform is a total package. You don't just take one and leave the other, because he has come with fuel subsidy, the naira, the value of the naira. Other things should follow so that we have a composite package.
Eze Onyekpere is the lead director of the Center for Social Justice, or CSJ. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Tanzanians in the diaspora are expressing hope that the government keeps its promise to allot them a special status by the end of the year. They say previous governments have failed to do so despite repeated promises over the years. This after the Foreign Minister, Dr. Stergomena Tax, announced in Parliament that the government plans to establish a special status for Tanzanians in the diaspora by December. The new policy would grant them access to some rights enjoyed by regular citizens, including land ownership and access to financial services. Tax says the move would also enable them to contribute to the country's development. Tanzania does not allow dual citizenship. This, analysts say, prevents citizens who become naturalized citizens of other nations from losing privileges that they previously enjoyed as citizens of the East African country. Faraja Logome, a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam, tells me that the government should allow dual citizenship, which he argues would benefit the country.
The Tanzanians are divided about that one. They are divided in the sense that there are those who are supporting that initiative. They're saying it's a good step towards having the dual citizenship in future. But there are those who are still skeptical. They're saying it is still something that cannot benefit the Tanzanians. But you can remember the amount of the money that comes from the diaspora in our country is huge, but still it's not the one that we expected to receive. Because with dual citizenship, people are saying, if you officialize or if you allow dual citizenship, there are some Tanzanians who are born abroad, but they would wish to have Tanzanian citizenship because their forefathers or their foreparents came from Tanzania. And so they would expect to be coming back and to invest in the countries. But the problem is the law does not allow for the dual citizenship.
But Faraja, yes. Some people are suggesting that a lot of African countries have dual citizenship and they are reaping the benefits of it. And that by stopping short of instituting yes. that policy makes Tanzanians lose a whole tranche of money.
This is historical, and the government seems to be not changing fast as the world is changing. They are still relying on the ideas during the post-independence. You see, soon after independence, the majority of the economy, those who were managing or holding the powers of the economy in the independent African countries were the Tanzanians of the Asian origin. And so the government had a fear that the economy will be in the hands of the Tanzanians of Asian origin, And so they discourage the dual citizenship. But now you can see many Africans, many Tanzanians are empowered. They are abroad. They are living outside Tanzania. They are living outside Tanzania, and some have children there, and they would wish to see their children having Tanzanian citizenship, even if they will also hold the citizenship of the countries where they are born. So they are not hurrying up. It's the right time for them to spearhead the dual citizenship, because it is so beneficial to Tanzanians, because they will bring more money back to Tanzania, but also we will attract more investment from the diaspora compared to the current arrangement that people should only send the money to their relatives who are in Tanzania. But if they will be allowed to bring back their investment, eventually we are going to develop our economy. And we are also going to create more employment to our people through the money that will be coming from the diaspora.
What is the majority of the people in Tanzania saying about the best step forward in actualizing dual citizenship, saying that it is not enough to give the Tanzanians in the diaspora a special status, but they should go a step further to embrace citizenship in whole, just like many other African countries and neighboring countries of Tanzania are currently doing?
In fact, majority would wish, as I read from the concerns on social media, media platforms, majority would wish not to end up with the special status. They would wish to see them given their dual citizenship, because they have learned from other neighboring countries. It has never created any problem. You see, the issue that is brought by the politicians here is about security concerns. It's about money laundering. If we allow them, there will be money laundering. There will be threats to the national security, because those people can also act as spies for the other countries. So they are using the old Cold War excuses to be applicable now as an excuse to refuse to give them dual citizenship. Something that does not hold water, because if you want to threaten the national security, you don't need to have a dual citizenship. Even a person with a single citizenship can also be a threat to the national security. You don't need to have a person with dual citizenship to be an accomplice of a bad person who can threaten the national security. So that excuse does not hold water, because not everyone who is outside there with a dual citizenship will always plan bad things to the other country, or to be used by an enemy of our country.
Faraja Lugume is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
I'm a piano, it's a big vibe, but the girls, them know.
Right now, it's time for music from African Collection.
Shout hallelujah. Every day it feels like a new year. Overseas they won't chop me like suya. Omo, I know we know what is true, yeah. Tire so greasy, oh, greasy, oh. Need to dance like Chris Breezy, oh, easy, oh. Omo, my wrist, did they cool, did they freeze, oh. Them know they call me Mr. Money for no reason, oh. I see they go, I'm a piano. We go show, we go let them know. Now we get on the town and any show. We got down any woes, we got down any foe. Bad man flows, put them on their toes. On the low, we got them know. Salty Jamo, Colorado, pass me the fat joke. My piano, piano, it's a big vibe, but the girls them know.
Steadily, steadily, heavily, heavily.
I'm a piano, piano, it's a big vibe, but the girls them know.
Steadily, steadily, heavily, heavily.
Say you want the man, we go do you better. Olo we turn no dollar. The king bomb of meta. Sexy jola, jala, dina leta. I'ma how they feel your style. When you break your back for me. Free me, you know easy. This thing plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my baby. Make I know where you want.
meja. Sexy jala jala nida leta. Come on, I can feel your style when you break it down for me. I don't know, baby, can you see? Penny Baba want joke, you know what it be. They want your bango on the low. But if you ready, one move, make a follow go. Anything what you do, mommy, me no go deny you. Baby, no go for job, and me no go for. Make a do you normally, you know what I mean. Yeah. Free me, you know easy. This thing plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my baby. Make a know where you want to see me, baby. Take a me. Plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my duffel bag. I know where you want to see me, baby. You say you want to
My name is Divine Tembenba from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothy. Stay tuned and don't change that dial.
listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C.
Friends about VOA Africa, music, sports, and news.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hove, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, stealing the village drum is easy, but beating it is another issue. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, Washington, D.C.